So, you want to talk about cars? Ferrari, GTO, Bentley, CRX, and even down to your great-granddad's Peerless. Welcome to No Driving Gloves, the car talk authority. Enjoy the ride. Now your hosts, John and Derek.
We finally arrived. It didn't let
there
us come into the picture.
Are.
How are we rolling, John, tonight, Derek?
There. Hey, doing good. You disappeared there for a minute, John. I was like, maybe I'm hosting the show on my own tonight.
It's this new podcast set up in the new studio I have. Doing the standing podcast thing, and I got all this mobility. Got two different computers rolling, so hopefully we can get it in this wrong color shirt, though, for the camera tonight.
I think you got to get a different shirt going, John.
Let me go grab a green shirt, and then I'll just be this head hovering.
I was just going to say you need to be the floating head of Oz. You pay no attention to the man behind the microphone.
So
we usually don't anyway, but
don't do that to me. I feel bad.
All right. Well, it's another week, and John and Derek are back with another live stream podcast episode of No Driving Gloves for all of our wonderful listeners out there in the No Driving Gloves community. And I think we got a pretty interesting discussion tonight that I think a lot of people get confused about, John.
Yeah, it's something you really don't realize, but you know, you'll be there and somebody will say to you, man, that's a cool car. You need to donate it to a museum so you can be remembered and the car will be preserved forever, or you need to take advantage of things like that. And we're going to dive into that. But before, anything exciting happened for you this week?
Anything exciting happened this week? Not really, John. It's been pretty slow. I will say this for any of our listeners in the Nashville or greater Nashville area that, you know, may want to make a couple hour drive on Saturday morning. Saturday at noon at Lane Motor Museum, I will be doing one of our demo days. We do four demonstration days during the nicer weather seasons. And this weekend, Saturday, I will be demonstrating our 1885-86 Benz Patent Motorwagen replica alongside our 1896 quadricycle built by Henry Ford replica. So this week I've been getting my hands dirty at work and getting our quadricycle replica running for this weekend. Puttered it around the vault this evening before coming home, see how it's doing. I got some fine tuning to do tomorrow, see if we can get it running just a little bit better for this weekend. And then we'll do some of the more major work that needs to be done to it post-demonstration. So I'm getting my hands dirty at work. I enjoy that.
Yeah. I know that's something you've been missing, all that book work and that. You miss getting your hands dirty. Me, I'd probably rather be on the office side of things. I went out to the Mob Inc. Car show on Saturday, and for a first event, that was a pretty happening place. It was unbelievable, the diversity in cars, the number of people. It's going to become a monthly car event, like a Cars and Coffee or whatever for Birmingham. But it's, I don't know what to say. They had a ton of stuff. I want to say you want to name it, it's there, but Derek's going to pull something out. And I know there were no Citrons there. There were no Model Ts yet, but I have a feeling Ts and As and so will start showing up. We had our Ferraris, four-wheel drives, and some overland vehicles, go-karts. Phil was out there with his RX-7 that's been to SEMA in the last few months and hit a couple magazine covers again. Of course, he parks it way in the corner and hides it because he doesn't feel like it's that special of a car. If you're listening tonight, Phil, when your car's at SEMA, when your car's on a magazine cover, it's kind of special, and you should be proud of that. That's an accomplishment. I can't tell you the number of days I sat there and I looked at the cover models on Playboy and go, man, I hope to one day, looked at cover trucks on Mini Trucking and that, and one day I hope to achieve that. And I never did. I was just happy to get the picture in the back and Reader's Rides.
Oh, so, I thought you were talking about looking at some of the old collector car magazines and the Playboy car that was on the front cover of.
I forgot what podcast I was hosting here.
Well, it could have been a Playboy car from the 50s, or it could have been a Jordan Playboy from the 20s that was on the cover.
Jason, we didn't have any Koenigsegs that Saturday, but I will say I wouldn't put it past one showing up at some point.
Oh, nice. Oh, and hey, Toby's here tonight. Hey, welcome, Toby. And thanks, Jason. I was on the cover of a magazine, and I did have my clothes on. I was not the centerfold, so you can all see me when my clothes are on.
Well, that isn't that the old song, we don't have to take our clothes off to have a good time?
Sure, if you say so, John. Normally, we talk about cars here on No Driving Gloves.
Well, drive naked.
Pretty sure people have done that in the past.
Hopefully, they had cloth interior.
It depends on the season, right?
Well, we don't need to bring depends into nakedity. So let's get back to our topic of discussion here.
I think that's a good idea.
We deviated enough. How do we want to jump into this? Do we want to talk the good, the bad, the ugly?
Oh, I'm no driving clothes after dark edition. I'm good with it.
You still play in the museum world, so you might have to be nice. I don't play in the
play. I like this. I don't. And on a topic like this, I'm usually not nice about it. I'm nice to donors. I am not trying to be arrogant here, but I'm very good at donor relations. I build good relationships with donors. And I'm very upfront and honest with donors. There are some nonprofits, and I'm not lumping that just into the museum world, because there are not a lot of other nonprofits that accept donations of vehicles. But there are some nonprofits that are not upfront about what is going to happen with their vehicle when they donate it. But as a curator, and someone who is also very passionate about vehicles, I believe in being very honest with your donor and explaining to them exactly what is going to happen with their donation. And it doesn't have to be a vehicle, right? It can be archival material, automobilia, things like that, that we collect in the museum field. But the big thing is just to be upfront and honest with your donors, because that makes the best donor relations in the future. And so, but I tonight will probably be very blunt, John, because I'm also getting a bit aggravated with the automotive museum world and some of the things that are happening inside of it and going on at various institutions around the country. And I'm also starting to wonder a bit about how long some automotive museums are going to be around because of some of the things that are going on. So it is no driving gloves after all, right?
Exactly. And we've talked about this off camera quite often about some of the issues and problems in museums. And if we get there, we get there. I just always find it interesting how automotive museums in the museum world are, what I want to say, exempt from all the other rules of every other museum on the planet. They think they're their own thing, but they want to then have all the benefits of everything, at least certain ones.
I said something like that, John. Well, but the other thing is, and No Driving Gloves is not a automotive museum podcast, right? But John's worked in automotive museums and in companies that conservation groups that work directly with museums and has a strong connection to the museum field. I am still a part of the automotive museum community. The only way to change the issues that are going on is to talk about them. If we stay quiet, we're not going to change. And that's, so it's just, it has to be talked about, and we'll get there eventually.
Well, let's get into what I publicized in our cover art for this episode, and that you collect it, you get done with it, you donate it because your friend tells you it needs to be donated, and you're going to help this great organization, whether it be a museum or whether it be a medical charity or be ASPCA or it. Whether you're going to help somebody by donating, and it's going to get preserved, and you're going to get a little bit of advantage. And especially when it comes to the museum world, you think you're going to donate it to a museum, and within weeks, it's going to be on display, and your name's going to be on a little plaque next to it, and you're going to be remembered forever for donating your 77 Ford LTD to Henry Ford. And that's not necessarily the way everything works. And sometimes I don't know how to get into it without diving deep into it. Even if you donated a very special, unique car and it sits in a collection or a museum for years, and even maybe displayed for years, at some point it may find another home, it may go elsewhere. We see all these auctions that have museum cars in them. And then the other one is the Peter Mullen Museum, or the Mullen Museums being auctioned off. And I still think this is a tragedy. I assume as quickly as it's happening, he knew it was going to happen this way, and it probably had set up his estate this way. But to go through your life and collect these exquisite cars and be in this one facility where you can see them. And then the money that he had, that he didn't leave an endowment or anything for this collection to continue. It's just, I'm gone. I don't get to enjoy them anymore. Let's just all break it all up and let 100 different people enjoy this stuff. And I don't, to me, that's a loss, and it hurts my heart as a car person, that a lot of these cars, when they're in the Mullen Museum or in a museum or in a collection, they're there to be seen. And when they get auctioned off and divvied up, they get into these private collections. You never see them again. Say everybody who goes to the auction buys four of his cars. So they all going to go home and go to, these people aren't going to display four cars to the general public. It's just kind of a loss. It's like artwork. You're never going to, Bill Gates is never going to open his home for you to go through his art vaults and see his paintings. And to me, it's a tragedy that some of this stuff gets shuffled away that way. And it's a tragedy for people who get there, who make donations and are not educated on how that donation may be handled.
Okay. You have to like get a drink or go to the bathroom, because tonight is going to be one of those nights where, you know, usually runs away with a conversation and talks for 10 minutes. And I think tonight's going to be the other side of the coin, where that's probably going to be me. So I'm just going to launch into a little bit here on some of what John just talked about. And I guess number one, I'll start with the Mullen collection. And, you know, number one, what a fantastic collection that Peter Mullen together. Art Deco, and there were other outlying vehicles in that collection, but that was the core of that collection. And yeah, you know, the greatest cars of that period are in that collection. Some of those cars were owned in partnership. I don't remember which one it is now, but one of the cars was actually Peter Mullen owned 49% of it, and another gentleman owned 51%. that gentleman is keeping the car. That car is not going to auction. But stepping back, the vehicles that are going to auction, those were Peter Mullen's cars. And we talked a little bit about this a couple episodes ago when we, you know, announcement came out that Mullen was going to be auctioned. But what we have to remember in the case of Peter Mullen and the Mullen collection, what that was really a private collection turned museum. All of those vehicles had been purchased by Peter or Peter and Associates. And, you know, although there was a foundation created and they had, you know, a 501c3 status, if you really looked at the Form 990s, which are public knowledge, there wasn't a lot going on with the foundation. It really wasn't, and this isn't, I'm not trying to badmouth the Mullen collection in any way, but it wasn't being run the way public trust museums that we think of, the Henry Ford, Peterson, the Studebaker National Museum, the list any name of a museum that is really a true public trust foundation. It wasn't being run that way. It was really Peter's collection accessible to the public in the end. And so Peter made a decision. You know, he knew his time was short. He knew he was going to pass away. Very clear, he and his family had discussions, and this is what they decided. And there was an article that just came out, John, I think it was maybe yesterday. I forgot to send it over to you, but they actually interviewed wife and his widow. And, you know, she talked about the fact that they had the discussion of how the legacy continues. And it was Peter's belief that he was the caretaker for the vehicles until he passed. And the legacy was then to have them find new homes. So that was Peter's mentality on that. Is it a shame to see the cars kind of up and go to different places? Yes, but he's also, in some ways, he's right, because it was his private collection, more so on display to the public. You know, legacy be that he wants the cars to now go on and have other caretakers. You know, that's the right thing for those cars and that collection. And so, you know, in the case of that, I don't see a lot of issue behind it, other than, you know, shame to see such a great collection dispersed. Now, what you also brought up was these cars going into private collections, which I like to call sometimes the black hole of the antique automobile world, because, you know, when you own a Model T or a 490 Chevy or a Ford Falcon, or, you know, so basically, let's break down to the cars that people like I have, which are very commonplace, not terribly historically significant vehicles. Having them be your private collection that your buddies see every now and then, okay, that's kind of, take them to the show, take them to the cruise night, everybody gets to see them, it's fun. But when we're talking about historically significant vehicles, and I've brought this up on the show before because there was a video put out, a group of people that owned some significant race cars from very early in Indy history. And one of the comments made in the video was very anti-museum. I'm sorry. No, you are wrong to own a historically significant vehicle and lock it away in a private collection and only invite your closest friends over. And like John said, even artwork. And I shouldn't say you're wrong. That's a strong statement. I guess I should make a strong statement. But to remove any historically significant and important artifact, whether it be a vehicle, a piece of art, or anything like that, from the public's view and researchability and understanding of that artifact and why it is important is a disservice to cultural history. And that is where museums come in, to aid in protecting those artifacts and educating the greater public on why they are important. And, you know, and we can break down through this episode why it's difficult for museums to do that, because, you know, an average, this is averaged out across all fields of museums, not necessarily just automotive or art or history or anything like that. But on average, we tend to have about 30% of our collection on exhibit and 70% in storage. Because when we exhibit our artifacts, we place them in settings that are, you know, actually talking about and discussing the importance and how they connect to other things. And we try to give them space for you to understand and see them. In storage, we can park cars and pack art by side carefully and safely, where, you know, you don't, you're not able to see it, and it's protected and safe. So it's much easier to have a larger part of the collection in storage and allow the exhibits to be enjoyable and educational. So yes, do we still keep things in storage? We do. But the other great thing about a museum or an archive or anything like that is, if you really are part of the general public and are really interested in researching it and learning more about it, you call, you make an appointment, and those institutions will pull those artifacts out for you to research and be educated on. Call a private collector and tell them you want to come see whatever significant vehicle they have in their collection. Guess what your answer is going to be, unless you know them. They're going to be like, who are you? And no, you cannot come see this. I'll take a breather, John.
I was wondering if you were going to take a breather, because you're saying it's so true. And I've seen it. And like you said, backgrounds with a couple of museums. It's also, I've dealt with private collectors and individuals. I much prefer working in the public sector than for a private individual, because there's not a passion to me sometimes with the private individual. Yeah, they might love this thing, but it becomes acquisition, and it's possession of property. Where in the public spectrum, I like educating. That's why we do this podcast. That's why we're approaching 7 years of talking to you for an hour a week about cars and all variety of topics. Everybody says we should narrow down our focus, and we really should only talk about blue Model Ts, and we would have such a listener base. No, we'd have a dedicated listener base, but we talk about the car culture in its entirety. And that's why we have to, you know, kind of all over the board, and you never know what topic you're going to get. And now the topic might change from the title card, and the topic might change three times during the show. But working in the museums I did, working for the private individuals I did, and then working for the conservation companies, which exposed me to car museums, art museums, history museums, space museums, plane museums. You dealt with furniture. I've dealt with shipwrecks. I've dealt with, you know, and sculptures. And just to see the differences in each organization, institution, car museums, and transportation museums in general seem to redefine museums, and maybe they shouldn't be. And like Derek was saying, the Mullen collection was a 501c3, and Jason commented that it should be owned or managed by a group of individuals, trusted individuals. And that's the way it's supposed to be. But it's used as a tax shelter and allows, and I don't want to get into dodging taxes, etc., but it's not properly used the way it should be. A government creation, and the government doesn't have the ability to monitor it. And I've been involved with institutions and experienced institutions when they have the audits that it may lose their 501c3, blah, blah, blah. And then because they're not doing everything they're supposed to. And I've never seen one. Derek's experienced some, you know, museum our nose of a museum that's lost their 501c3. But it's just odd. It's I'm saying it's a lot. Where I took this topic is, I hate it when you donate something, your pride and joy as an individual. And this is the exact opposite of what we've been talking about. You're an individual and you want the world to see this thing, and you donate it to a museum, or you want the world to experience it, so you donate it to a nonprofit who says they'll sell it on and they'll have much more exposure than you. And you give away your pride and joy. And yeah, you might get a tax benefit out of it. Maybe you just get the satisfaction of knowing it's going to be cared for and loved by somebody. And then you give it to some institutions, you go back 2 years, 3 years later, where is it? No, it's in the warehouse in the corner. Can I see it? No. It's buried. You know, that's not why you gave it to them. Or you give it to, touched on a podcast a couple of months ago when it happened. Gentleman had a car. He tried to sell, super show car. Everybody knew the car. He had it for sale. Nobody bit. And he just decided, well, I can donate it to this charity and it will, you know, they have better exposure. They have a better, you have a selling business, and they can get this into the right hands, and maybe they can help somebody finance it, and somebody can enjoy this car. And I mean, if you know the car, you know, it was a Beretta, gold plated, hydraulics, custom wheels, everything on the car was custom and such. And it was in good shape. And the guy donated it. And what happened? And they looked at it in the NADA blue book or whatever. And then, oh, the X year Beretta, it's worth $1,500. So we'll just send it to the pull apart. And that's how it made news. 3 days later, this Beretta is in a pull apart, stripped, but custom paint and pinstriping and artwork that was on it identified it. And the owner's just beyond himself that his life's work, his art was destroyed like that. And it wasn't how it was presented to him. And the nonprofit said, well, we just looked it up in the book. And if it's not a certain dollar value, we just ship it off to the junkyard. Did they tell him that? No. Did they, you know, maybe they did. Maybe he only heard the pretty part of the story. But it's unfortunate. I also have a question. What did they value it when they gave it to the guy, his receipt for his donation? Did they value it at $1,500, or did they value it at the $12,000 or $13,000 that he was asking for it? And pennies on the dollar for what he had invested.
Well, but it's just, John, that, hey, well, that's one thing that has to be cleared up is the nonprofit would not have valued it. Any donation that you make to a nonprofit, if it's over $5,000 or $5,000 and over, you have to have a third party appraisal. So the question becomes, what did the third party appraisal say on the value of the car, which the nonprofit, technically, the donor doesn't have to share that with them. He could have gotten a huge appraisal on it and had one tax write-off, and he didn't care what happened to the car. There's a lot of questions to be asked in this scenario. I would say, but
there's a caveat in your statement, though, in that even if it was independently appraised, and say it was appraised at $100,000 and this guy took a $100,000 tax write-off, if the nonprofit disposes of the vehicle within it's either a 2 or 5 year window, they need to obtain at least 50% of that appraisal. And obviously giving it to a pull apart
tax return,
to a pull apart like that either destroyed this guy's appraisal or, it's
which may be why he was upset. Yeah, true. I'm trying to point out that the questions that have to be asked, and you're asking the right questions as well, John.
And we're saying this here to educate you that if you're going to donate something, these are questions you need to know too.
And do your research on the organization that you are donating something to. Are they reputable? Have there been issues in the past? you know, if you're working with, you know, a lot of museums, you can look up their not only their Form 990s to see what their financial status is, but a lot of museums are also on, GuideStar. And you can see a rating of how transparent they are and how, you know, their credibility of the institution. So there's research to be done. And the other thing is, and John, I'll kind of this in the way of kind of, you know, let's I guess pretend that say you're wanting to donate something to a museum that I'm working for, and you were to reach out. And yeah, you get in touch with the curator, myself, you want to donate a vehicle to the museum I'm at. And the first thing I'm going to do is, number one, I'm going to tell you that we will want to either come look at the car, or if it's, you know, far away, if it's not local, ask you to send pictures and, you know, a history of the vehicle. Why is it important? What's significant about it? All those sort of things. And it's going to be reviewed by a team of museum staff, because no museum should have one person making the ultimate decision on artifacts come in to the collection, because then it becomes solely the interest of that person. And so it'll be reviewed by a team. And what I always say is one of the most difficult parts of being a curator, or the most difficult part of being a curator, you have to learn how to be really good at saying no to someone, because they're trying to donate something to you that they feel is extremely important, likely has sentimental value to them, and they think that the institution should want it, because it's important to them and there's value, sentimental value. So why wouldn't it be? So we have to be really good at saying no, and being able to have the fact that a committee or a team is the one evaluating the decision gives you some extra support, because it's not just you, the curator, saying no. But you know, you just have to approach it when you, and museums and other nonprofits that accept donations have to be good at saying no. That's kind of the root of some of the issues. Sometimes you have to be good at understanding that you have to say no because you can't handle it. Or in the case of especially museums, we have a mission statement that keeps us kind of us where our collection needs to go. And if a artifact, vehicle, piece of art, whatever it is offered to the institution, and you cannot take that object and say, okay, this is our mission statement. This is the object. Does this object fit directly into that mission statement? If it's a yes, then okay, we should consider it. If it's no, it doesn't fit the mission statement, then conversation's over. Time to call the donor and say, we thank you very much for this offer. It does not fit with our collecting initiative or our mission statement. But what I can do, and this is what I do, but what I can do is recommend that you reach out to X, Y, and Z museums, because their missions fit the story of this artifact and they may be interested. And here's their contact info. So like I say, you have to get very good at saying no to these things. Donors call in. But the next step beyond that is that if you say yes, that you do are interested in it being donated, then you have to be very transparent on that donation process. And I always have a lengthy conversation with the donor. And I also always send a copy of our deed, what's called a deed of gift, which is the deed you sign when you gift that object to the museum, so that they can review it. And if they have any questions, they have time to ask them to me before they make the ultimate decision to donate it. And almost every museum, if anyone listening has ever donated a museum or ever considers it, read that deed of gift very carefully, because they are all put together by our legal counsel. And every deed of gift, well, almost every deed of gift a museum has, will always have a line that you are turning that object over and giving away all of your rights to that object. Therefore, the museum is now the legal owner, has any copyright that comes with the object, you know, is now the museum's. And it is ultimately also the museum's decision what happens to that in the future. In other words, we have the right to process that we call deaccession the object and sell it out of the museum collection if it eventually does not fit the museum's mission or no longer is something we can care for. So thing is transparency in doing this, especially if you want to have good donor relations.
Yeah, a topic popped into my head in that because of a post you actually made on social media. And excuse me, you did not make the post.
Right.
The Lane Motor Museum made the post that occasionally they have to sell cars from the collection or, you know, out of the collection just because they don't fit they're not going to tell the correct story. And what I liked about that post is there they are on social media being upfront that, hey, we're going to sell this stuff. And there's nothing wrong with them selling the stuff. You donated or however they acquired it, whether the Lane Museum went out and purchased it, whether it was donated. However, it's their right to do what they choose to do. And by selling this stuff off, it brings funds back into the museum for them to purchase other artifacts or continue operation. You are still benefiting the museum just because, abstract, you donate a 74 Pinto or an 83 Escort to the Lane Museum and they never display it, but they sell it a few years later for $2,000. You donated that car, or hopefully you donated that car to benefit the museum and the museum patrons' experience. Now, granted, they might not get to see your Escort, but the money derived from the sale of that Escort allows those museum patrons to see other exhibits or allows them to do it in a climate-controlled facility or allows the lights to be on, because you would not believe the power bill for certain museums and things like that. There's expenses to all of this that needs to be covered to continue, so the museum can continue operating. So there's nothing wrong with it, but I really liked how upfront the Lane was. And they actually have a page on their website, and there's a nice little selection of cars and car parts of it right now. And not that I spent a bunch of time looking, there's very few other places that I've seen actually have that. And I've been exposed to institutions that are very secretive when they're, I call it a deacquisition, just because I don't like to read the whole word. I mean, I just fill in whatever letters I want. But they might sell it on eBay under somebody else's name, just, or somebody else's account, just because they don't want to be associated with it. You don't want to know that they're getting rid of this thing. And it's really fine print. You know, it's, I think, 8-point fonts as small as you can put into a contract now. And it's 8-point font that at some point in time, the museum may choose to, you know, or use this, you know, to however the museum sees fit. Which, again, it's okay that they're selling it. They're using, you know, they're creating funds to preserve the museum and continue the museum, which is what the donation should have been for in the first place. The donation shouldn't be to immortalize you in some building because you happen to own 58 Ford Fairlane. I'm sure it's throwing out a lot of cars today. I don't know why. You know, it's There's nothing wrong with it. I don't object to it. It just needs to, I just hate the secrecy that some places use and deal with this. And like I said, I've been exposed to it. I've seen it happen in places I know of. And I know in places that I've never even had contact with, I've seen the same thing happen. And just let's not be secret about it.
Yeah, I want to jump in on that, John. Number one, I want to touch on Jason's point. So it might be better to put an object on loan to a museum if you aren't sure what they will do with it. You can certainly try that. Tend to only take loans if we are looking for an object for a specific purpose. So a lot of times people will call, be like, oh, hey, I have this. And it seems to happen around late fall. I get a lot of calls. And people have cars that they think would be great on loan to a museum until about, you know, April, early May. I don't know why that is. I don't know why you'd want to put a car into a museum in fall and then pick it up in the spring. But anyway, loan thing, most of us will turn loans down unless we're specifically looking for something. But John, to your point about the secrecy, I think part of that with museums comes from the negative reactions of the general public to museums deaccessioning and selling objects because they don't understand. They think that museums are society's attic. And yeah, well, I don't know what to do with mom's old, from 1860s. So I'm going to give them to the local historical society and they'll always be there and they'll never do anything. And, you know, just think that I hate to say this, but a lot of people think museums are dumping grounds for stuff that they don't know what to do with, but it's old, so it should be in a museum. And it causes a lot of problems for museums. But the worst thing that has happened is when museums go through, and there have been some inappropriate, that have done things inappropriately, but for the majority of museums, they go through an appropriate process of deaccessioning objects, selling them normally at auction so that they are put out to the public and fair bidding can occur on those objects. But negative reactions come out. How dare you sell things that people gave you? How dare you do this? How dare you do that? And, John, you touched on a lot of great points about, we do that because if it no longer is, fitting the mission or fitting the stories we tell and we can no longer care for it, it is better for the museum to put that object in someone else's hands, get some money to put back into preserving the rest of the collection. Your donation is still recognized. It is still recognized in the money that is received from the sale of that object that you gave. So you are still a donor to that museum. It's not like you've erased your history of being a donor. It's still in all the records. You're still recognized as a donor. But what really, really irritates me is the general public that comes out and has negative comments against museums that do this process and sell things at auction. And you ask those people, have you ever supported this institution? Have you ever donated money? Are you a member? And they sit back and go, well, no. Well, then you have no right to say what is good or bad about it because you do not support it. You don't go visit it. You don't. Why? Just because a museum, which you think is a dumping ground for anything old, is selling something, it doesn't give you the right to be negative. And that is why a lot of museums feel they have to do things in secrecy, because there are these people that will come out and badmouth the museum and say all this negative about the museum. And yet they've never once helped support it. They've never once visited it, been a member of it, or anything like that, because that's also what helps us not have to, deaccession collection sometimes. If we have robust budgets and we can build more gallery space. We can build more proper museum storage facilities. Then we can collect more and preserve more. But if the general public is not going to get behind that, then this is what has to occur. And that's where I will get really angry with people if they want to sit back and complain and yet never give support to institutions.
And see, when I first was introduced to museum world and museum culture, I didn't know that. I thought museums, when they acquired something, they kind of put it on display. They put a plaque on it with your name, everything that I said earlier that you expect to happen. And that's why we're doing do these podcasts, and they're kind of random. But that's why we're doing this podcast, is I'm going to say something, and I don't mean to be political or anything, but it's educating people. Once you learn about something, it's like AIDS or take AIDS, for instance. Once we're educated on the problem, excuse me, it's not nearly the problem. We know what happens and why it's there. So we're here to educate you on a little bit of that background museum that you don't realize. It goes in the back room of Walmart, you don't know, then you'd be upset about a lot of the stuff that goes on in the back room of a Walmart, but you don't know. But when you find out, you get upset. Exact same thing here. This is the back room of what happens in museums, and people get upset. But it's done, as Jason said, that, and Derek said, and John said, you've trusted the museum with your donation to use it the best way possible. And sometimes the best way possible is to turn that into cold hard cash, or to even just free up the space for something else. I mean, we've all done it with our car collections. We've got a 4-car garage and we want this 5th car. We might have to sell one of those cars out of the garage to get the 5th car. You might sell that C5 Corvette so you have room to put a C8 Corvette in that spot and use some of that money to acquire the C8 Corvette. It's no different with museums. That C5 Corvette does not fit your lifestyle or your collection anymore, and you want to have that C8. So you sell that off, you use the money, you take the space, and you put a C8 Corvette in there. And that's exactly what a museum's doing, is they're selling off their 14th Model T so that they can get a Model A, because they need a Model A. Me using all these different cars tonight. So it's simple. It, like I said, we're just trying to educate you. Once you become educated about what goes on behind the curtain, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes it's a funny thing, but it's not necessarily always a bad thing on what's happening backstage.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, I'll bring it up and our institutions out there, and maybe institutions should be in air quotes, that are not upfront. They're not doing things ethically and appropriately. And that's why I say, do your research. If you're thinking about donating something, be it a vehicle, be it a piece of art, be it whatever you are considering, do your homework, do your research. Make sure that the organization or the institution you are donating to is upstanding. It is transparent. And, definitely don't think that these are easy decisions for these organizations. There are often multiple meetings that go on behind the scenes, from the collections team meetings to meetings with the executive director. And in most museums, if you're deaccessioning something large like a vehicle, there is also usually board involvement and sign off. This deaccessioning is in most institutions that are upstanding and ethical, is a very difficult process. And it takes a lot of time to decide on what to deaccess, make sure that it is, number one, you can deaccession because, you have to be within a certain, as John mentioned earlier, 3 years if it's donated, a lot of stuff that we have to understand about taxes that goes into that. But then there are multiple people involved as those terms we have even in our, as John said, let's not get political, but you have to. There's a thing called checks and balances in this world, and we have them in museums as well. Again, one person can never make the ultimate decision. It has to go through committees and meetings to make sure that things are being done correctly and that the museum is not doing something unethical, because that is when we lose things like 501c3 status. And if we are accredited by institutions like AAM, then you lose your accreditation as well, which is a pretty big black mark on an institution if they have accreditation and lose it, because then people ask a lot of questions. If your GuideStar rating goes down, people will start asking questions. Well, why did your rating go down? What weren't you transparent about? So it is never a decision that is taken lightly to remove and sell objects from museum collections, but it does happen. Again, the big thing is if you want to see museums grow and you want to see collections in museums grow and better exhibits and more exhibits and more space, then you have to help us out as nonprofits, and you have to become members and you have to support us with donations, and collection wise, because that's how we operate and that's how we grow. So, but again, in my opinion, and in I think a lot of people's opinions, it's still better to have historically significant vehicles publicly, or historically significant artifacts, be it automobiles, artwork, dinosaur bones, Revolutionary War weaponry, and armor, whatever we're talking about, they are better in the public trust and in public spaces to be educated, educate with, than they are locked away in private collections where no one ever sees them. Because how are we going to learn and grow as a society if we lock everything away where no one can actually be educated from it? So that's my pitch.
Well, I think it's a pitch we're going to kind of, say like, subscribe, ring that bell, all that stuff I'm supposed to say when we are on YouTube. You get notified of it. We go live, but we're live every Thursday night, 9 p.m. So, be sure to check us out. And I think Jason says it best in his statement here. When you go to a museum and a cup of coffee, probably not worth the $25 they're going to charge you, but it's going to support the museum. And when you go to museums, you buy all kinds of things that are really overpriced. It helps at the grassroots level. With that, you buy us a coffee here at No Driving Gloves, and it's only $3 a cup. So you can go to our website, click the buy us a coffee thing, or if you're watching the video, scan that QR code and you don't ask for money a lot. Never go to cover the costs. We do this again to educate you, have fun, talk to you every Thursday. And I think we've had a very educational conversation. I'm sorry we don't get over the top enlightening and funny and blah, blah, blah. But we're here to educate, and that's what we do. And don't feel bad when the museum sells your beloved 75 Honda CBX, maybe 79. I don't know. It's a motorcycle. I ran out of cars. So with that, I think I'm going to just go ahead and say, after Derek talks, get off your ass, go burn some gas, because John is out.
You really messed that one up, John. Guys, if you want to help your local museum, donate money, support, be a member, things like that. If you want to help No Driving Gloves, as I always say, Help us grow. Share the show. See you next time.
Do, 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 do.